accession number 238486.
Mr. Wildgust, Reel 6. Right, Mr. Wildgust, we're still talking about Sandhurst. Now, you've mentioned earlier in the interview, talking about some of the officers you encountered, and you know, you weren't that impressed with them. You mentioned at Sandhurst, you know, the kind of public school type of of officer. And did you feel that maybe there was there any sense of which that you felt that maybe these people were like out of date for what you were being trained to do with the war? That's obviously this was post Dunkirk, and
I think I don't know, but I think this particular officer, Captain Foster, he was a First World War officer, and he, as I say, had the MC. I don't know whether he'd been called up in that particular job at Sandhurst. I don't quite know how it worked in those days, but he was still of the First World War idea. In fact, I think that he was imbued with the old traditions. A lot of them, of course, were younger. Most of them were regular. Well, nearly all regular, for that matter. But they were a little bit more modern in their outlook. The sergeants, again, were regulars. But by this time, of course, it was 1942, and some of them might have only joined slightly before the war and sort of got more into the rhythm of things. We didn't... they were more active as well. When it came to training exercises, the officers were more involved than they had been in the other battalions I was in. But they expected more, and the training was very thorough. I think it was about 6 o'clock we were up, and we had sometimes a parade before breakfast and drill. And certainly after breakfast, you always had drill. You seemed to have drill every day. And it reached the point when we were proud of ourselves as well, because, as I said before, it's quite amazing how everybody responded to the type of training we're given. One, you had to, but the other was that there was a certain amount of satisfaction in seeing how everybody improved. And from my own point of view, I found that the expected smartness was a bit of a worry. I say a worry because it didn't seem to matter how clean and well polished you were, your boots were, and how well creasy, they always found reason, you know, they could always criticise you, which is, you can with anybody, can't you? And I remember being on guard one night, and this particular Captain Foster happened to be a duty officer. And we'd been walking, we'd been patrolling the grounds with our rifles slung, which meant the, I can't even remember the phraseology nowadays. The rifle straps were open because they'd been over our shoulders. Now, when you turned the guard out when the older officer came, of course, you had to stand with the arms sloped, and if your rifle belt wasn't tight, they would notice it. So I had, of course, who should come on parade? So I had to hook my finger around the slack belt of the rifle and pull it taut, and as he passed and passed, and I've never been so relieved in my life, because a thing like that, you'd be on parade for or doing drills probably for a week. I remember once I was on parade and I hadn't got my braces. That's right, you had to have braces, belt and braces. I got a belt, I got any braces, so naturally my trousers sagged a little bit. And for that, I got a week gardening in the adjutant's garden. And you had to go before the company commander for that as well, when they usually found, again, something wrong. That, so it was very minor things you got punished for. And But anyway, the same for everybody. I mean, I had friends who were forever worried. As I say, the benefits were that you had good accommodation and you had a servant to look after you. To
some extent. Who the servant was?
No. No, they were civilians, of course.
Oh.
No, civilian servants.
So you did a lot of drill. And you probably did a lot of drill.
Yeah.
What else would you do on a typical day? Take us through a typical day after the drill.
Well, there'd be weapon training. There'd be what they called TOETs, tactical exercises without troops, when you had a sand table and did theoretical attacks or defensive positions. The live route marches, of course, and live weapon training, we did quite a lot of that. I remember the Canadians gave a demonstration of the 3-inch mortar. Now that was quite interesting because the Canadians don't mess about, whereas it took us probably a month to learn how to take a Bren gun apart. They would produce, as they did once, a 6-inch anti-tank gun. And they said, this consists of a barrel, a breech, and some wheels. And you put the shell in there, and that's, you know, that was all done in 5 minutes. Anyway, we had to go to see the exhibition or demonstration of a 3-inch mortar. And they said, always remember, always put the cap back on the barrel when it's not in use, because if it's raining and water gets down the barrel, it can cause a lot of confusion. So they fired one shell, which went about 500 yards onto another hill. And he said, now, you see what happens if you leave the barrel untouched. So he poured some water into the barrel and put another bomb in. And it fell about 200 yards. Anyway, long way short. And he said, just imagine what would happen if there was a real downpour and you got all this water, so he poured a hell of a lot of water in here, and then slowly put this bomb in. Well, I've never seen anything quite like it, because that bomb seemed to go in slow motion. It went slowly up into the air and started to arc, and I've never seen the ground covered so quickly by officers in great coats, looking very smart, suddenly flinging themselves flat into the mud, as we all did. I mean, at least we... Some of us cowered, but some of them... And the ground was covered with flattened men. And, of course, this bomb drops slowly down, and it was a dummy. And he picked it up and said, there you are, you see what happens. And the officers, very shamefacedly, got back to their feet again. But we did that sort of thing. We did live grenades. We had exercises where you were supposed... you're probably going through a wood and then somebody'd jump out at you that side, and or there'd be somebody in a trench, and you were supposed to react immediately to what you would do and what weapon you would use at the time. Of course, it's all right in theory, but it's different in practice. We had a very good chappie who did the battle noises. he was a civilian, and... he was very good at pistol shooting. He was one of the few men who could really fire a pistol, because he always used to say if you could hit anybody in a room at 6 feet, you'd be lucky with an army pistol. And he made very effective charges, explosions. Until, unfortunately, one day one of his explosions didn't go off, and he went to look at the circuit and forgot to switch it off, and blew himself up. And we buried him there. I found I was a pallbearer, and that was the first time I'd ever felt emotion at anybody dying. Not that I've come across many people dying, but I did feel it with him, because he was a nice man. He was about in his 50s. But the lesson was that it didn't matter how expert you are, you take care. He'd got up to the charge and tried to reconnect it and forgot to switch it off.
Can you remember what he was called?
I've got it in here somewhere. I should...
And you're looking at your diary of the period.
Dennis William Knight, 59. A civilian employed at the Royal Military College, went to see why one of his charges not exploded. He bent down. The charge went off, killing him instantly. And, yeah. That'd be a lesson to all. But apart from that, I mean, it was... you got guard duty, picket duty at night, and you presented yourself on Sunday mornings for church parade. If you were C of E, if you were other denominations, or RC, you fell out on the left. And I was a Congregationalist, so I used to go into Cambly. I can't even remember going to church, but I walked into Cambly and... we had the morning off, sort of thing.
So you pretended you were going to
church? Yeah. I may have gone once, but because RCs and other denominations didn't have to report like the others did. It's a very impressive chapel, actually, at Sandhurst. But, and we had the last night, we had concerts. Every company had to put something on. Another thing I can't understand, I volunteered to do this. I mean, I wrote a play and I did various things. I didn't sort of feel any stage fright or worry at all. I just stood up there and did it. And
can you remember what it was?
Well, it was a parody on the army to start with, one thing and another. And in those days I used to do some very amateur...
Impressions,
which went off quite well, but of course everything had to be sort of army.
Now, just going back to the weapons training. Obviously, mm-hmm. you've been trained on the Lee Enfield, young soldiers, and you've been trained on the Bren. Was there any new weapons that you were trying to learn yet?
No, grenades, of course. No, we didn't get any new weapons until in Africa. And that was a case of, that's your weapon, this is how you load it, and it was all over it in 2 minutes. But the only new weapon that had come into the army at the time was the 2-pound anti-tank had been replaced with the 6-pound anti-tank, which the Canadians gave us a very quick demonstration. Not that it interested particularly, apart from we felt at last the British Army had got some new weapons, which was about time.
What about, the Thompson submachine gun? Did you encounter that?
No, that was a clever thing. I forgot all about the Tommy gun, yes. Oh, yes, we did that. When you fired that, you were told to fire it off to the right, the width of a magazine, and down to the bottom left or something, the width of a magazine the other way. yes, that was another weapon we did use. The boys' anti-tank rifle by this time had sort of died a natural death. And the Vickers machine gun, of course. That was the... I did a lot of training on that.
At Sandhurst? Mm? At Sandhurst?
Yeah.
Not with the young soldiers, though?
No.
What about the Thompson? Did you do that?
Did that at Sandhurst. I don't think we did that in the other... No, we didn't. I can't remember anyway.
Right, now, you talked earlier about the civilian instructor talking about the pistol, the army pistol being effectively useless.
Yeah. Mm.
Now, apparently at this stage of the war, there was still this convention of the officer
carrying
a pistol.
Yeah.
Mm. Did you discuss that amongst yourselves?
Well, that was a thing that was... I don't know if it came up at Sandhurst, but it certainly came up very quickly, that officers on active service should get rid of their pips and become soldiers. You know, I mean, the first thing I did, I didn't remove my pips, but I made sure they were either dirtied or covered up. In fact, we were in such atrocious weather, we never sort of got it out of anything. I had a greatcoat or an anti-gas cape or something over it. And I got myself a rifle. First thing I managed to do, although there weren't any spare at the time, had to wait for somebody to be wounded to get one. But the pistol I never used, never used it at all, and it was the Webley 45, as far as I can remember, But even this man who knew his weapons said that he could hit a target at 25 yards, which we thought was absolutely amazing that he could do this. But it was looked upon, we had pistol shooting, but I don't think I ever remember anybody ever hitting the target. And it was only done from 20 yards or there.
So what did you think about this at the time when you were having this?
Well, we assumed we would never have to use it. Like the bayonet, we assumed we'd never have to use that as well.
But I should have asked you earlier about bayonet practice. Was that
of course, bayonet. That was done in the early days. I can't remember ever doing it at Sandhurst. We did more fixed bayonets than Sandhurst than any from that respect. And it was a thing that people really didn't talk about much because they hoped you'd never have to use it. But
now, you mentioned these tactical exercises without troops.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just take us through possibly a couple of the kind of scenarios that they would be trying to teach you? I suspect this would be platoon level tactics.
It was mainly platoon level. Sometimes you got a company officer there, a company commander who would give you a demonstration with platoons, you know, of a company. And occasionally you'd even have one with a battalion. But it's strange, when you're in these positions, if you're in a section of a platoon, that's as far as you're interested. And if you're in a platoon, you're not really interested in the company, particularly, unless you're drawn into it. And everything gets very insular. You know, anything that happens 5 yards away from you is not of your interest at all. It's only that which it personally affects you. But to a large extent, these tactical exercises were of not much use to a platoon commander or a junior officer, because they were never involved in that type of thing, you know. They were told what to do, we hoped, by people who knew what they were talking about.
Now, might sound like a silly question, but would they also have tactical exercises with troops where you would be playing these roles of platoon commander and other men playing the role of
The last, during the last month or more at Sandhurst, you had to take over the platoon as a platoon commander and or a sergeant. And our company commander at the end said, I think the final report was about a month before he left. And he said, if I'd have seen how you reacted to a position of authority, I'd have made completely different, I'm talking to me generally, but I'd have made far different assessments, because when a person is put in charge, all of a sudden you are in charge and people do what you ask them to do. When you're in a subordinate position, it's more difficult to get people to do things. But when you're said, he is a platoon commander, you'll do what he says. And you found it was quite, I did, I found it was quite easy. Talking of exercise, I remember one we did at night, and the idea was to cross the Thames near Runnymede in a salt boat. And we started off about 10 o'clock that night, and
Robert Wilgust, you were saying you were on an exercise.
Yes, we were up somewhere around Runnymede, and the idea was to cross the River Thames with a company, and two of us, I remember, we were up in the heathland around there and blackened up, feeling very soldierly, and we heard this singing voice coming across the heathland at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And we decided to ambush him. And this poor bloke was a Canadian soldier who, when we leapt from the grass with our rifles, said, "For God, don't ever do that," he said, and nearly fainted. However, when we got down to the river, we had to take the company across in assault boats, and I was one of the paddlers, and we went across and came back, and I had very much endured at the time Sanders of the River, which was Paul Robeson in, where he sang this river song, "I E O Co," etc. And on the last crossing, it was dawn, and it was a lovely morning, and I broke into this song, and all of a sudden, there was complete silence. As it was supposed to be done in silence anyway, it was not the thing to do, to sing as you paddle. And of course, sitting in the back was my platoon commander, who fortunately took it the right way and didn't hold me responsible. By that time, it was too late to do anything, because we'd only got about another week to do. But I'm afraid that was another almost black I put up.
Now, when you were doing these exercises, would you always be working with fellow cadets? It would be a platoon of fellow cadets. So during this training period at Sandhurst, they would never send you out with, say, a group of 30 ordinary soldiers and put you in charge. There was no contact with,
it was always cadets. But of course, it was only in the final weeks that the cadets were in control of other cadets. It was always the proper officers and NCOs of the guards, and they treated us like guardsmen. I mean, it was you weren't just going to any regiment, you were going there. That was, of course, was when you were asked what regiment you wanted to go to, and I put down, I think, the Foresters, Leicesters and Lincolns, because I didn't know any better. And I was duly commissioned into the Foresters. And I say that quite advisedly, because I went down to the local tailor and the Foresters uniform, and I got it, and you got your coupons and you got your money. It wasn't until I was wounded that I was suddenly realised, or at least the War Office instructed my mother that I was in the Oxen Bucks Light Infantry, attached to the Foresters. And I said, that's a load of rubbish. I've never heard of the Oxen Bucks Light Infantry. I certainly wasn't commissioned into them. But they said, oh, well, you were. Anyway, I went back to my regiment, and they said one or two expletives and said, well, we'll get you transferred back to the Foresters, which they did. Which was, I believe, quite unusual to get transferred from one regiment to another, but they managed it. So for a short time, I was in the Oxen Bucks Light Infantry. I was on the strength at Colchester. I was in the Times under their regiment as being wounded in action. But that's all I ever knew of them.
Now, before we get to your actual commission, commissioned into the Foresters in the Oxen Bucks, was there... during your training period at Sandhurst, were you ever in kind of training under live firing conditions, where they were live rounds?
Yes, they did that, and I, on reflection, I think it was the daftest thing they ever did, because it certainly affected me that when I was under fire, actually, I didn't bother about it, because you sort of said, well, I'm used to this sort of thing, they've done this, and they'll never hit you, which was rather a mistake, you see.
Could you describe what the training was?
You'd just have one or two, when I was commissioned and did it with Charles, I mean, you had one or two experienced or reliable riflemen, and you fired shots over them, or you got your Bren gun or machine gun on a fixed line and made sure it was on a fixed line, and they just sort of fired a burst or two in a certain direction and you hoped you wouldn't hit them. I mean, I had occasion after the war, I mean, after all this lot, of two boats were shot on a scheme of Northumberland, and one had creased his head. Didn't kill him, thank God, but it was a bit dangerous, because I mean, I did the same. I mean, I remember firing live rounds, and a chappy said, you nearly killed me, sir. I was up this tree, and he said, this bullet went past me. But of course, I fired in the air, because it was a natural place to fire. But I don't think it really did any good at all by using live ammunition. Didn't make you any more aware or more careful. False sense of security, in a way.
Now, just on a different subject. You were at Sandhurst, you're on a private's pay at Sandhurst. Now, you've talked about some of the more privileged cadets.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they were you know, an independent means, as it were. Had you given any thought to the fact that, you know, once you were an officer, you know, things like mess bills and so on, that come into your mind at all?
No, it didn't at all. Oh, I mean, bearing in mind that...
the expenses of being an officer.
Second Lieutenant was paid 10 shillings a day, which was, I suppose, by our standard, wasn't bad, but... No, it didn't... I suppose you expected, at least I did, I expected things would fall into line, you know, and you'd accept it as it was, which in fact I did. I didn't find... In fact, I felt quite rich after 10 shillings a week. You have £3.10 a week.
Now, did you have time to socialise outside of the military establishment?
Oh, yeah.
To get into town and,
yeah.
And so on?
Yes, yes. Better not put that down. Yes, we used to go to London occasionally, and I remember before we'd finished, I went into London with a friend, he was a good friend of mine, Viscount Erskine. I've got an idea he was killed, but we call him Alice. Oh, Alistair Erskine, his name was. And a chappie called Roy Rogers, who eventually went into the Guards, or both did. And Erskine had family. His father, I believe, was Viceroy of India at one time. But they certainly had a country house, and they had a London house, you see. So we went into London, and I remember buying some cherries from a costermonger, and they said, oh, we'd never eat in the street, you know. And we went to his house, or his father's house, in one of the squares around Piccadilly, and we were greeted by the butler and the cook, in the downstairs basement. And it was rather like a period play on TV now, that when they were sort of, welcome, Master Alistair, you know. And he said, boy, here they are. So to make conversation, I said to the butler, have you had any trouble with the air raids around lately? Well, he said, I do believe we had an incendiary through the roof on the fourth floor, sir. But I do believe it's been covered with a tarpaulin, and we haven't had any leakage. I thought, talk about taking it easy. And that's all stuck in my mind as phlegmatic, I think, is the word, is it not? That he could have been. But Alice, he was a very nice fellow. I met Roy Rogers after the war in Nottingham. He knew somebody and met him in a pub. We just passed. And I was out of the army, I believe, then, but he was still a regular. But we hadn't much in common.
Now, were you, as an officer cadet, was there a special uniform that you would wear?
Yeah, you wore the same uniform, but with white, white band around your cap and white things on the epaulets. You didn't have any... I can't remember that. I can't remember whether you could keep your regiment... No, you didn't. I don't think you kept your regimental flashes up.
And did you feel, you know, better dressed, more of a man about town kind of thing?
Oh, yeah.
In that previous
Well, of course, you stood out a little bit, you know. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.